you may have seen is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Actors, right? The road to fame and celebrity. All right, I get it. You've had an incredible life.
Aren't you sick of hearing about them?
Me too.
The only problem is, I'm one of them. Except I'm not famous.
Oh, you've probably seen me.
A bunch of times. I'm the guy with the information about the hero's dad. I'm the doctor that can't figure out what's wrong with one of the main characters. I'm the guy they just punched in the face during the interrogation. My name's Brian LaFontaine, and I'm a professional actor. Oh, and it's not just me. There's a ton of us.
We're the ones you don't hear about.
Yeah, we're the names that scroll by at lightning speed during the end credits. But there's way more of us than there are of them. We're important too, dammit. Because without us, they can't tell the rest of the story. So this is for all the movie and TV prostitutes, homeless people, drug dealers, cab drivers, cops numbers 2, 3, and sometimes 4, the pilots, the waitresses, and girl at party.
This is You May Have Seen.
Today I'm talking with Jim Gloster, from America's Most Wanted to an Emmy Award. Of course, happens all the time. This guy may just be the nicest and hardest working guy in show business. We talk Veep, Ballers, what it's like being a 6'3" Oompa Loompa, and getting no love from Andy Griffith. So buckle up, we're coming at you in 3, 2, here we go.
Yes, all right, so Jim Aloysius Gloster, we meet again. You get a lot of nerve. Did I even get that right? I have no idea what your middle name is.
But I'm going with it.
That's
I like
good.
That.
I like it.
You call me Al for short.
That's right. Or Jag. If those were your initials, then you would be Jag. Wow, no, that's unfortunate. I'm sorry about that. We'll have to take that back. All right, so Jim Gloster, where may we have seen you?
Where may you have seen me? Oh, my gosh. Depends on how old you are.
Right?
You may have seen me back when I was considered myself an actor as a murder rape accomplice in America's Most Wanted.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because that's not on here.
It's not.
No. A murder rape accomplice.
Yeah, yeah. It actually took place in West Jefferson, which is where I have my place in the mountains.
Oh, God. Hoping the neighbors don't recognize you.
And we went up there. Yeah. So these two guys, you know, raped this poor girl and threw her off a cliff, basically.
Oh, sweet
and
Jesus.
So I went up there and played the accomplice.
Wow.
And, I don't know that they ever caught the guy.
So you could be like in huge trouble because you know that they still rerun those damn episodes on one of those cop channels.
Oh, for sure.
So was that like the first, was that before all the other stuff that's here that's listed that's legitimate, quote unquote?
No, that was after, probably.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was in the middle of my acting career.
Of your robust acting career. So, you're the first one that has brought up like one of those reenactment shows. What are those even like? Did you have to audition for that for America's Most Wanted?
Yeah, audition. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and it's just like, you know, screaming and yelling in the audition,
right? Because the writing's really
and
good.
And freaking out because I was the guy who freaked out. You know,
oh yeah.
Once the guy, you know, he was the guy who really did it.
Right.
I was just with him. So,
did you look like the guy? Because I know that that ends up having to be a lot of the prerequisite. Is
well, my guy actually turned on the other guy, so they were really looking for the other guy.
Okay,
so my guy had already turned himself in, so I didn't have to look as much like him. As the other guy.
Okay, so then you may be in the clear.
Yeah,
you may be
maybe,
fine.
Maybe.
All right, this
unless
this,
I meet him, right? He gets out of jail and he comes up. I'm like,
this is. This interview is actually special in a lot of ways because I am actually talking to Emmy Award winner Jim Gloster. Yeah. Emmy Award winner. You were the 2017 Primetime Creative Arts Emmy Award winner for Veep for...
Production design.
For production design.
Yeah.
You were the production designer for Veep.
I was. I mean, it's over now. So, but yeah, I did 6 years of that show and the pilot.
Man.
So.
Now, you are... 5, 6-time Emmy nominee?
Five-time
nominee. That's that's what I had looked up. But
we finally won number 4.
Right.
And then we go back September 15th, and we'll see if we win a second Emmy.
That's amazing. That's really, really just like, well, I mean, crazy. How the hell did this, I know how it happened, but how the hell did this happen?
I know. I ask myself that all the time, really. It's just like, you know, I mean, I've always been in the theater. I've always done everything in the theater. Acted, you know, built stuff, designed stuff, right. and whatever. And, you know, it really just came to a point where once I had three kids, I had to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A lot harder to do in Charlotte, North Carolina as an right. actor than it is as a technical person.
And sure.
So I was the tech director designer for Theater Charlotte, the community theater here, for 6 years.
That's how we met.
Yeah.
First time I met you, you were building sets. So, I mean, I've always known you to be a designer and a set builder. And,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. A production guy as well as an actor. Because, I mean, you were a fantastic actor. I always enjoyed watching you on stage and on camera and working together.
Right.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. We got to do, was it just the one show? Was it Midsummer, the one show that we did, I think?
Maybe. That was a fun show.
It was a fun show.
Great show. Yeah.
That was a painful show to rehearse. Yeah. You remember that shit, right? I used to, during rehearsals, there was this one move during the dance at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Jim played bottom and I played flute. I'm talking to people like there's actually people listening. You guys know. And the way that they had it choreographed, I would have to run to Jim and literally wrap my legs around his waist and just kept racking myself in the crotch over and over and over.
Wow, that's
again.
Bringing back some fond memories.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Right. I hadn't thought
right.
of that in years.
Yeah, oh, Jill yeah. Blady and I just retold the story about the last performance with the boob kiss. Remember
oh, yeah.
that
yeah, yeah,
with the
yeah.
jank?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That was just, that was 1995, man.
Don't count. Don't do it.
Oh my God.
Don't even do it.
24 years ago.
Right.
I was three at the time. Yeah, you were the production designer for Veep, for Ballers, for 13 Reasons Why, Eastbound and Down, a movie called Morning, which I was also in.
Oh, that's right.
I was.
Yeah.
The Closest Thing to Heaven by our good friend Doran Pentis that I was also in that he cut me out of.
Did he really?
He did.
That's your first time ending up on the editing floor?
Because it was the first movie that I ever worked on.
Right.
He ended up cutting that scene at the end and I was devastated. I was devastated.
No,
right.
It's soul-sucking, the acting business.
It really is. You're also an Art Directors Guild Award winner. I looked that up. That interview with that girl on the red carpet was hysterical because she had no idea who you were. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, have nobody knows who we are on those things. We're production designers. They're like, what? I mean, people even ask me, I went to the dentist this morning. They're like, production designer? What the hell is that?
And
my mother, as an art director, my mother is like, what do you do? You know?
Tell us what you do.
Okay, well.
Make it clear for everybody.
All right, well, I started... I was an art director for years, and an art director is basically the project manager. So we have all these sets to build. If we go to a location, we have to paint them or make them look whatever. So,
right.
So we have to design these sets. We have to build them. We have to paint them. We have to dress them. You know, we have to make them look like a real thing. So as an art director, I would be the project manager of that. So as the production designer, I'm the guy who makes all the decisions of what it's going to look like. So I've got a huge crew that works for me. I've got, set designers who are the draftsmen. I've got a decorator and a whole set dressing crew. I've got a paint crew. I've got a construction crew.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a graphics person that works for me. So, you know, I'm the guy in charge of all the things that you see behind that big actor's head that's blocking all of my scenery.
Right, right. But it's still an extremely creative process.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very, very creative.
How exciting is it for you, like, when a new season or something different in the script shows up or, you know, what? All right. So they send you the script. What happens?
It's kind of like a disease
because,
you know, you're so stressed out from doing all the other scripts, but then you get a new one. It's like, oh, boy, you know, candy. You know,
Let's
look at this. Let's see what this brings kind
of
thing. So, you know, sometimes it can be terrifying, you know, because it's like, you know, it's like we're in Baltimore and it needs to look like Helsinki. Okay, we'll figure that one out.
I never even thought about that. That's going to be incredible.
We're in Los Angeles and we need to make it look like Tbilisi, Georgia, you know?
Right.
And so yeah, some of that's, and then, you know, you just got to start delving into the research and figuring out what that stuff really looks like. And I found a great, because we had to, for Veep, we had to build an apartment of this, this oligarch in Tbilisi, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So my source of research for that was Airbnb.
Really?
Yeah. So I went on Airbnb and said, okay, does anybody rent places in Tbilisi, Georgia?
Oh, sure.
And of course they do. And then you got all these pictures of all these places, and then you can just kind of mix and match and pull stuff and, you know, just get the feel of what it looks like. So
So, the internet is an amazing thing.
It is, and I don't know how we did it before.
No joke, right?
I mean, it took a lot longer.
Right.
But, you know, now they expect it to happen in 2 days or one day.
So. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Like, what is the schedule like for you on something? Give me anything, for example. One episode, an entire season. How far in advance do you know what you have to do?
Sometimes a week.
Really?
I mean, sometimes we're just working off an outline, depending on the show.
Yep.
I mean, Veep was like that a lot of the times because the writers were just, you know, constantly writing. Then they'd change it or they'd have a table read and all of a sudden they'd be like, eh, that's not funny anymore. You know, we've been sitting on those jokes for 2 weeks, so let's write new jokes, you know? And so, yeah, sometimes we're just working off an outline and you know, we have a week to get some stuff done. So it's normally a 6-day week.
Wow.
And, you know, 12-hour days or more.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course, of course.
And now it's away from home because our state has gotten rid of all the film work.
Yes.
Just about our stupid state.
Yes.
So now I'm in Los Angeles and
right.
many other places.
Do you have a place out there when you're hanging out there?
No, I Airbnb it.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, had I been smart and known that I was going to be there for 5 or 6 years,
right.
I would have bought a place back then. And you know.
Okay. So did you always assume that that season was the last season?
Yeah, I kind of always assume that.
Yep.
They want me back.
Right. And you also never know what's going to happen with the show. I certainly understand. Like, you know, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket and then have the rug pulled out from underneath you because that sucks. And now you're stuck with this.
And, you know, how long is the show going to go on? How long are they going to want to do
That's
it?
That's what
know?
I mean.
And then, you know, the beginning of season 6 when Julia, you know, was diagnosed with breast cancer, you know, we had the sets 3/4 of the way built and ready to go. And then the producer calls me and says, we need you to lay everybody off. Tomorrow.
Wow.
And I'm like, why? Like, we can't tell you.
And
so we waited probably about 4 days, everybody going, you know, after we'd said goodbye to all the carpenters and the painters and everybody. And then finally Julia announced. And then after she announced, they let everybody had a meeting and said, yeah, we're shutting down and we'll be back whenever she's better.
Right.
So.
And to put everyone's mind at ease, she's good now, right?
Yeah,
she's good.
Yeah,
she's good. She's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
is it working with her?
Well,
I mean,
she's delightful.
I
mean, she's amazing. I mean, she's got the strongest work ethic of any actor I've ever known.
I mean,
she's there all the time, even when her scenes are not going on.
I mean, right.
Because she wants to be part of the writing and the story. And, and so, no, she's a delight. You know, the hardest working person I know.
That is amazing. So let me ask you this, though. 5-time Emmy nominee, 1 win. Does it suck losing after you've won one?
Well, people say, did you have fun? I said, well, I could have had a lot more fun.
Did you rehearse your loser face?
Yeah, exactly. Luckily, nobody really cared because it's the creative image. You know, they call them the schmimmies, right? So we're the week before the, you know, the main Emmys, basically.
Right.
So so it's not like anybody's looking up on YouTube to see your loser face and that kind of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, I got to say, 4th time was the charm.
Yeah.
And it was a lot more fun, you know, because what happens is, the very first time we did it, they're 4 hours long because there's so many Creative Emmy Awards.
Right.
So then the next year they divided it into 2 different nights.
Okay.
So that, you know, you wouldn't have to sit. But even then, you know, once, you know, if you're first up and you learn, you know.
Right.
You
know, right.
Everybody just goes to the lobby and drinks.
Way to be supportive.
Yeah, right.
Don't take it personally, but I'm out of here.
I'm out of here.
That's fantastic. Okay, fine. You get the job on Veep. I mean, we can talk about, and we certainly will to some extent, like all the things that you did that led to Veep. Because
right.
it's not like it just happened overnight out of nowhere.
Right.
You're a badass. But then you get nominated for an Emmy Award, and then you win an Emmy Award? Jim Gloster, I've known you for 25 years, for more than that. And, I mean, did you ever see, think, imagine any of this happening?
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, you know, just think how lucky you have to be to even get a show that can showcase your talents and that is, you know, well received just as a show.
Right.
No matter what it looks like.
Right.
To be even considered for that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a...
That's just
Yeah,
crazy.
So I'm incredibly lucky to have landed that show.
Absolutely.
And for that show to be the hit that it is. Because if it wasn't a hit and people didn't like it, then...
Of course.
I don't care how good it looked.
Right.
You know, I would
right.
not have gotten
right.
nominated.
Well, again, I mean, I've known you for a long, long time, and I've seen a bunch of your sets, and they've always been fantastic. Now, this is something that obviously, because you and I come from the same alma mater.
Yeah.
Went to Catawba College.
Oh, yeah.
You were a theater guy. I was not. You were there 100 years before me because, you know.
Not 100.
No one can see you. Yeah, Jim is really old in comparison to me. Actually, when were you there?
80 to 84.
Okay.
When were you there?
88 to 92.
Okay.
Yeah. So not too far ahead, but no. I mean, but you went there for theater.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you going to be an actor at that point, or you were just like, I just want
to
be
I was going to Broadway. I was going to be. Yeah.
Were you really?
Yeah, my first interview with those guys when I went there to interview for scholarships and stuff. They're like, what do you want to do after college? I'm going to be on Broadway. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I was going to be an actor. And, you know, like they hadn't heard that before.
Sure.
I mean, everybody comes in and says that, I'm sure. But, and it didn't work out that way.
Where are you
way.
From?
Born in Indiana.
Oh, shit.
I raised in Virginia.
Okay.
And then I moved here my summer. I graduated from high school in 1980.
Okay. All right.
And then went to Catawba.
Right.
After that summer.
So when did the acting thing begin for you? Where did the
fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
Fourth grade. I
want to hear that
my
story.
My first play.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't remember what it was. It was some stupid school production. Oh, no. It was, God, what was it? Love Hits Wilbur. That's right. And I was Wilbur.
I was going to ask, were you Wilbur? Was Wilbur a person or an animal?
No,
or?
No, he was not a pig. He was...
What? Now, what did Wilbur get hit with?
Love.
Oh, but
Love hits Wilbur.
Okay. And that just figuratively?
I guess.
I don't want to see show.
It's fourth grade. I'm lucky I remember the title.
But obviously, that gave you the bug.
Oh, yeah. No, I had the bug early on. I knew I wanted to you know, I was one of those kids that had the ventriloquist dummy. And
did you really?
Talent. Yeah.
What was the dummy's name?
Charlie McCarthy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know. Yeah. So I was a drama geek from way back when.
And so you did it in high school and all stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I went to audition to Catawba, you know,
right,
for scholarships and all that. So yeah, and decided not to do School of the Arts. I'm not sure why. I think I was intimidated by it.
Okay.
So you didn't go to act?
I didn't. I went on a golf scholarship. You remember that?
You do now.
Yeah, yeah. Catawba and Elon offered me a small golf scholarship, and I liked the feel of Catawba better. I'd never heard of it before.
Right.
The athletic director for my high school in Providence, Rhode Island. Here's what's funny with that story. I went to him and I was like, hey, I want to, you know, see if I can find some schools who might be interested in having me play golf for them. And he was, you know, this Italian guy, football coach, you know, meatball of a guy. Didn't know the first thing about it. He's like, let me make some calls. So he calls me back in his office like a week or so later and he's like, I found a couple schools. A buddy of mine, he's in prison. I'm not even joking. He's in prison. He knows some people, and he made some calls for me. And I'm thinking, how is he making calls for you from prison?
Yeah, really.
In Catawba.
Collect calls.
Yeah, right. You graduate from Catawba. Why didn't you go to Broadway? What happened? Or what was the plan at that point for you?
I was, how would you say in the vernacular, a pussy, I think.
Yeah.
I think I was scared. I remember my parents from my graduation of college gave me towels that said, go for it. And I remember looking at those towels going, I don't know how to go for
it. I'm gonna throw those away.
So I ended up staying and living at home and working in a convenience store and working as a meat slicer.
Get out of here.
In a Daryl's kitchen for, you know, 6 months or so.
Oh my gosh.
And then the store where Tim Ross called me and said, I'm in an international tour of The Wizard of Oz, and we just lost our Tin Man. Do you want to go? And I was like, hell yeah.
Oh, wow.
Like, when? He said, we leave in 3 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I went on the road for a year.
Holy crap.
As the Tin Man.
Wow.
298 performances all over the country and Canada.
You were a working actor.
I was.
All of a sudden, you were a working actor.
So I get to the first rehearsal,
right?
International tour. Of the Wizard of Oz. Actually, the Land of Oz. We couldn't call it the Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
All right. I get there, I find out that there's 8 of us.
Okay.
Right? Which means that I have to play a munchkin. I'm 6'3".
Yes. Yes.
And so I have to don one of these big dwarf heads and a big polka dot hoop skirt and get up there and start dancing. Right?
Oh,
and
Jesus.
It was a reel-to-reel tape player. It was all lip sync.
Oh, my God.
So we would push the button on the tape and start the show. And we hated that reel-to-reel because it would just fuck up all the time. So all of a sudden it would start playing in slow motion, and we'd be out there having to dance in slow motion.
That is fantastic. That is fantastic. Internationally, so what countries did you travel to?
Canada.
The faraway land of Canada.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. And then, so you finished that,
right.
And then Charlotte Shakespeare happens shortly after that?
Yeah, came back. Jill got pregnant. We started having kids. Charlotte Shakespeare. Goodness. Did 7 years of Charlotte Shakespeare, mm-hmm. and then Theater Charlotte. And then once I kind of did my first commercial and made serious money, mm-hmm. I was like, you know, because I'd been 6 years at Theater Charlotte.
Yep.
Loved it. It was like my graduate school. I got to design and build all of the sets, right? But after 6 years and mainly 50-year-old women helping you build the sets on the weekends,
you're
completely burnt out. So I just figured, well, if it's not art anymore and it's just work, then let's just make some money. Let's go work and make money.
So, absolutely. So,
how I got into the film end of it.
Do you remember what that commercial was?
The first commercial I did was... some candy commercial. I can't remember the brand name of the candy, but it was a candy commercial.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just to let everybody know, again, I am talking to Jim Gloster, who is an Emmy Award-winning designer, but many people don't know that he was also an actor during like another lifetime in the story of Jim Gloster. I looked up your IMDb page, which is pretty funny that there's it's separate from your production page. It's almost like I want to forget about it. I want them to think it's somebody else. There's no photo of you. When's the last time you had headshots done?
Oh, Lord. It's been 15 years, probably.
Jesus.
Yeah.
You were in a movie called Tracks with Shadow Stevens and Priscilla Barnes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
That was my very first audition for a film.
Really?
And I landed it.
Boom. Now you're thinking I'm going to be a movie star.
My next audition was for a commercial, and I landed it.
You're a douche.
2 years later, I hadn't worked a single job. I swear.
So you must have been thinking, oh, this is easy.
This is so easy, you know. Drive to Wilmington, 4 hours to Wilmington, you know, say my words, get the role, and let's just keep going. Shh. Yeah, it don't work that way.
Do you remember what you did in the movie Tracks XX?
Yeah, I was the front guy of a whorehouse. Yeah. And
you have some of the, like, the list is short, but you have some of the best character names ever. You were also in a movie called Chattahoochee with Gary Oldman, Dennis Hopper, and Frances McDormand.
Can I tell you that story?
Yes, you can.
Okay, so it's a one word thing, but I have a scene with Gary Oldman, right?
Awesome.
And he's in a mental institution, and I'm mm-hmm. playing an intern, you know, that goes in and I say, pack your stuff, we're leaving in 5 minutes.
Yep.
That was it. Everything went great.
Yep.
Movie comes out.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take my family to see the movie, right?
Yep.
I learned that they had filmed that scene from outside the window, and the top part was frosted.
Oh, my God.
So you couldn't see my face or my head at all. And, you know, on top of that, they dubbed my voice.
Yes. So there was a nice little wake-up call for you.
Soul-sucking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. My God. Yeah. So you learned a lot about the film business at that point.
I did, yes.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, even the Shadow Stevens tracks. I mean, I got that, and the night I was supposed to go down, there was a blizzard, and it snowed 6 inches from here to Wilmington.
Oh, my God.
And so I called up, and I said, you know, are you postponing my scene? And they're like, no, we're just going to let the stunt guy do it.
Oh, no.
So I drove through the snow. It took me, I think, 6 hours to get to Wilmington because I had to go so slow to get down there to do this thing. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah,
I'm surprised that you were even able to make it at all.
Oh, you know, I wasn't gonna
6 inches of snow in North Carolina.
Hey, no way, I was gonna make that.
Holy shit! But I didn't even think you'd have a choice to make that. Like, God, snow here is ridiculous. Taking Liberty, which was that a pilot that never went anywhere?
That was a pilot that went nowhere. Yeah.
Bandit Silver Angel as Jasper. Matlock, you did 2 episodes of Matlock. You get to show your acting range there because it was actually 2 separate episodes and you were convenience store robber in one and cop in another. So, I mean, look at the broad. They were like, this guy's got range.
I'm telling you. So, convenience store robber, right?
Yes.
I get there and they hand me a ski mask.
No one wants to see your face on screen,
obviously,
man. One wants to see your face.
But my scene's with Andy Griffith, right? So I'm a huge fan, so I'm thinking, oh, this is great. I get a scene with Andy Griffith. So we're in a convenience store, which is a real convenience store location, and I'm standing there, and Andy Griffith comes walking up to him, and he mm-hmm. puts his hand out.
That's awesome.
And I reach my hand up to shake his hand, mm-hmm. and he walks right past me and picks up an umbrella sitting by me. So I just put my ski mask on, said my words.
That's like something right out of Charlie Brown, man.
It is, exactly.
Wow, did you have any positive experiences in the film and television industry as an actor?
There's a reason why I'm a production designer
now. Oh my God.
More with Jim Gloster in just a minute. You're listening to You May Have Seen, proud member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. There are so many great podcasts on the network, and they're adding new ones all the time, showcasing great stories by great people and shining a spotlight on the Queen City. You can find them all at queencitypodcastnetwork.com. Shoutouts! I want to thank Neil Singleton for his great message and comment on social media that he enjoyed the Kobe Ryan McLaughlin episode. Thanks for listening, Neil. Thanks to Chris Rubiz. I hope I'm saying that correctly. I apologize if I'm not, Chris. For the email, so glad you stumbled across the podcast. Welcome to the Southeast. You are not alone. I'm sure our paths will cross at some point soon. And I want to thank Jill Blady for letting me know she's been binging You May Have Seen. I love that. Thanks to her and our good friend Tyler Barnhart for the love and support on social media. I would not be doing this without any of you. So keep listening. Tell your friends. Okay, here's more with Jim Gloster.
You were in. You did an episode of American Gothic as, this is a great name, Just Eddie was his name. And I think I remembered, like, you were a thug or something in that. Like, didn't you get to whoop somebody's ass?
Yeah, well, I got buried alive.
Okay.
By Gary Cole.
Yes.
Yes, who's in Veep.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, did you get to relive that story?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So that was my first job where I actually got more than like 1 or 2 days. I had like a full week and a half on that job.
Yeah.
And it made a huge difference to be there on set, to be part of the crew, to be part of the whole thing.
Right.
You know, because I've always said that to be a day player is one of the hardest jobs in the world, because they are paying you to not fuck up.
Right.
Because if you're the guy who can't say their words on the one day they're supposed to be there, right? They're looking at you going, oh, geez, this guy, we just want to get the lunch, for God's sake.
Sure.
It's hard. I mean, there's a lot more pressure, I think, on day players.
Absolutely. And then Bastard Out of Carolina with Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah, that was my first appearance on the Emmy.
I remember that, too, in her clip, because she was nominated.
Exactly. She was nominated, and they showed our scene. So I was like, hey, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the movie Eddie with Whoopi Goldberg as the bellhop.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, you did some stuff. I had no idea that your experiences were so glamorous, shall we say, along the way. I mean, do you miss it at all? Do you miss it?
Well, here's the deal. They decided, I was in the van for Ballers because there's a lot of locations.
Yeah.
So we're scouting a lot, right? So,
right.
So I'm in the van with the location manager and the director, and we're looking for locations. And the casting agent of that show decided she wanted to tag along and shadow the director because she wants to be a director.
Right.
So, you know, just out of happenstance, I said, yeah, I used to be an actor. I used to do this kind of thing. And she looked at me. She said, I'm going to put you in this show. So owner number one, football player, owner number one of a team, I'm in 2 episodes of Ballers.
And coming up?
Coming up.
Because I watched the show and I haven't seen
you. No, coming up. Yeah.
Nice.
In this season. Yeah.
So, dude, that's awesome.
Yeah. So it was kind of, I mean, it was fun because everybody knew me. Everybody was just kind of, and it's amazing how freaked out people get. It's like my whole art department crew, they were just like, I mean, they sent me flowers.
How do we treat you?
Yeah, exactly. They just got such a huge kick out of it. And, you know, which is great, which is fine. But I'm just like, well, I'm, you know, just owner number one. But
still.
I mean, they redid all of the posters of the show with The Rock on them and put my face on them.
Oh my God.
And, you know, owner number one.
That is amazing. Yeah. This season on Ballers. Oh my God, that's cool as hell.
Yeah, so.
And was it always like that? Like when you were, because you were still doing production even when you still were auditioning when you were here. How was it when you were on set as an actor with the guys that you knew really well in production? Did they give you shit? Did they give you a hard time?
Oh, they gave me a lot of shit. Yeah. I mean, the surprising thing about the Baller scenes, and it was 2 scenes, I mean, 2 episodes, and you know, it's, we're at owners meeting. So it's like the football, NFL, all the team owners in a meeting. And I heard words with Dwayne, you know, I tell him he's out of line and all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
But people kept coming up to me and saying, oh, you can really do this. And I'm like, oh, I told you I'd done it before, you know.
It's right.
So I think they were a little surprised that, you know, that I didn't suck.
How was it to get back into it? How did it feel?
It was nerve-wracking. I mean, I was definitely nervous for sure.
Right.
Which, to be honest, is probably one of my biggest drawbacks for me as an actor.
Right.
Were my nerves.
Sure.
They got in the way.
Of course.
You know, and
I think that's very,
I was
common,
just a lot more comfortable building and designing sets and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it just, that show came on just, you know, when they had to shut down season 6 of Veep because of Julia's illness. 3 days later, they needed a designer, and I was on Baller, so it worked out really well.
That's really, really great. Yeah, yeah. Now, was there a conscious choice to, when the moment came when you were like, okay, I'm just going to do production full-time, like, or how did that transition happen, or was there one? Or do you even really remember? It's like, it's just, well, I don't know.
For the longest time in Charlotte, I did both, right?
Right.
I mean, Theater Charlotte, building sets, you know, even when I'd do a commercial, I'd still audition for commercials, still driving to women, just trying to do that whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if there was a specific cutoff date where I said, okay, I'm not acting anymore. It just kind of happened.
Yeah.
You know, this just kind of took over.
Right.
And, you know, I'm pretty good at the production design thing, so it feels natural. It feels, you know, it feels really right for me.
Because I know for, you know, a lot of actors, there's a particular show or there's a little bit of a run that they get on that kind of moves them into a little bit more higher profile position. You know, we know a lot of people who have ended up doing some stuff where it's like, ah, now they're getting recognition from that. Was there something on the production side that you did that kind of moved you into a different group or got you in front of different people that were like, oh, this guy's good, let's...
As an art director, I worked for a wonderful production designer, Clayton Hartley, and he came here and did Talladega Nights.
Okay.
So that's where I met him. We went all over, and I was an art director for many years. Mm-hmm. And he is such a delightful person, such a wonderful designer, that as an art director, you just disappear. You're just in the background. So I had to do one show, which I won't name.
Okay.
Where the production designer was not that. The producers did not like him.
You know, he caused
problems. He blew the budget. He did all this stuff. And so I finally got to step up and people recognized me. And then that same producer asked me to go to Veep and production design Veep.
So, I mean, your life has changed in a way that you probably never really expected.
Oh, for sure. I mean, who would have thought I'd spend, you know, 5 years in L.A., you know, the last 5 years living out there 6 to 8 months out of the year, you know, and then coming back here and staying in my place in the mountains because that's the only place I want to be when I'm, you know, out of the big city.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. What is life like in LA while you're there for you? Is it just more of like head down in the office, we're working and...
Yeah. I mean, we're at Paramount. So I was for Paramount Studios for that whole year, which is a great studio. I mean, I loved working there. So, and, you know, it got really comfortable, to be honest, because, you know, I had my same crew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all became comfortable with each other. I was comfortable with the show, knew the actors and the showrunner. So everything just felt really, you know, nice and chill.
Yeah.
As time went on, I do stop sightseeing as much, you know.
Yeah.
You just kind of go home. And,
right.
Fix your Trader Joe's burrito and open your bottle of wine and get ready for the next day.
Okay, so it hasn't gotten that much more glamorous then.
No, there's no glamour at all. No, there's zero glamour.
How often are you actually physically on set when the show is shooting? Or are you
normally not?
Normally not.
No, that's the weird thing about being in Ballers, having a role. It's like I had to stay there the whole time. It's like, whew, this is long and really boring. Like, can I leave, please? The best part of my day as a production designer is we open the set, everybody goes, this is fantastic. And I'm like, okay, we'll see you later. I'm going to the next spot.
Now, what's the difference between trying to get work in production and trying to get work as an actor?
You know, it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't go read words, but I do go interview. And, you know, I had for Billions, which is I'm getting ready to go to.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. You know, I had to have a phone conversation with the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to do a Skype FaceTime interview with the showrunners.
Yep.
And then they had to vet me by going to all the showrunners I'd worked before and, you know, ask them what they thought of me. And then they called back and offered me the job. So, but that was a stressful day because I was actually here in Charlotte doing a commercial as a production designer.
Mm-hmm.
And the Skype call was going to be on that day. So I was walking around the house trying to find a place to have a Skype call while they're shooting a commercial in the next room.
Oh,
so I ended up in the little boy's room.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was great.
Then I got to think then the biggest difference, though, is that you're interviewing or you're quote-unquote auditioning, if we're going to connect it to acting, for a much larger chunk of work. You know, like you're talking about when we go to auditions and you're reading for, you know.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Intern. You're in and out in a day or a couple of days, and this, it takes you, what, 3-6 months more?
Well, Billions is going to be 10 months. I'm going to be in New York City for 10 months.
Yeah.
So it's a huge chunk of life, and it's a huge decision to go, do I really want to be away from home
right
that long, you know? And so I do love New York City.
It's a cool place,
and
man.
And the only way to be there is on someone else's dime.
Yes.
So they're going to put me up, and they're going to give me per diem, fantastic. And give me a car, all that stuff.
Oh,
so,
my God.
And they also agreed to help me travel back and forth on weekends. So, you know, it's, you know. You
look at
work.
You.
You might as well.
You're a fucking somebody now. Look at you. That's amazing. That's really, really great. But also, like, the job security has to make you go,
oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I can get used to this. Yeah. And clearly you have.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, the insecurity. I mean, back when I was in Charlotte, you know, Charlotte Shakespeare Company, mm-hmm. and then I would go into schools and do stuff, and then we'd audition for commercials, and then, you know, then I'd go deliver phone books.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I broke the suspension in my little pickup truck because we put so many phone books in the back of it that we went and delivered phone books. I mean, you know, so you're just doing all of that stuff to try to throw it together to make it work, you know.
Those are the salad days, man. I love that you're bringing that stuff up. Do you miss doing it? Do you miss the work? Are you working harder now than you did when you were working as an actor? Like, you've got to be working just as hard, if not harder now, I would imagine.
Well, yeah. I mean, the stress is definitely there.
Yeah.
You know? And, but, you know, if I've got a good crew,
yeah.
It's like, which I've had dynamite crews on both shows,
right.
Out in LA, I sleep really good.
Good.
Yeah. So, do I miss acting? I probably miss stage acting more than I do. I think going back and being in a play would be just a lot of fun.
Right.
It always was, right?
Right.
I mean,
oh,
you know,
of
it's
course.
Just that camaraderie, that working together to do a play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, film work for the money maybe, but,
sure.
You know, unless it was something really substantial that, you know, I thought, I mean, I played a lot of big dumb guys too. I mean, that was kind of my, you know, that was my forte. So
sure.
After a while, I was like, sure. Yeah, I don't need to play another big dumb guy.
Right. I get that. How long do you see this going on for you?
9 more years.
Really? Because then you'll hit retirement age?
Yeah, because I'm
okay.
In a union, and
yep.
You know, and I will have hit my, you know, my full benefits kind of thing, and the
okay.
and so, yeah. I mean, honestly,
yeah,
I'd retire today if I could.
Yeah, I mean, how is it with juggling it with the family? You know, because I know your kids are grown.
Yeah, I've got 3 grown men. So
yep.
They're 30, 32, and 34.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that doesn't sit well with me.
Jesus. It's hard, isn't it?
Oh, my God. Is it the family business now? Chase is working with you or has worked with you? Or
well, Carson.
Carson.
Carson is, he's in Charleston on a show, which I can't remember the name, but he's been doing, he did Righteous Gemstones, which was Danny McBride's show.
Yep.
So he's a lead man and a set dresser.
Great.
So,
yeah, so how does that work, juggling it with home life and Jill and being away and gone? And
well, we've learned to do
stuff.
It. I mean, she'll come visit, you
mm-hmm.
know, kind of thing. But, you know, our dogs are now our kids, and someone
sure.
has to stay there with the dogs. So, you know, that's kind of what divides it right now.
Right.
But, yeah, she comes and visits, and, you know, I try to get home as much as I can. And,
yeah.
You know, it's we've made it work out. You know, it just, it's hard to say no, you know.
Of course.
Sometimes I feel like I've gotten myself in a position where, wow, do I really got to go away from home for 10 months? But on the other hand, it's like, you know, that's what I do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
I'm not going to be able to do that here. Would I love to have a job in Charlotte
mm-hmm.
as a production designer?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Atlanta, you know, I can drive home on the weekends,
right.
You know, if there
right.
was a show there. So at some point, I would like to work closer to home.
Yeah, and I'm surprised that hasn't come up as an opportunity for you.
You know, it just hasn't. I don't know why, because there's so many designers in LA who are, mm-hmm. like, having to go to Atlanta to work, and they're like, we don't want to go away. All the
sure.
work's here in Atlanta, you know, and I'm the opposite, you know.
Right.
I'm out. But I lucked out because they brought Veep out from Baltimore,
yeah.
season 5.
Yes.
To LA.
Yep.
And so they were lucky. I was lucky for them to put me up then as well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You are also the writer, producer, and director of Aphasia, the movie.
Yes, I am.
With our good friend Carl McIntyre,
yes.
who I interviewed Carl a couple months back. And talk to me about that.
Well, I was, me and Michael Madison
mm-hmm.
were sitting at Sir Edmund Haley's bar.
Yep.
And Elizabeth called us and said, can you come to the hospital? Carl said, something's wrong with Carl.
Right.
So we get there and we learn that Carl's had a massive stroke.
Yep.
And Elizabeth has to make a big decision. You know, it was too late and they didn't know how long he'd been out. So it was too late for them to administer the drug, the blood clot thinning drug.
Right.
So they had to make a decision to insert the wire up there and break up the clot because it, you know, the clot lodged in his carotid artery and, you know, shut off the blood to his brain, basically. Mm-hmm. So Michael and I were there when all of that, you know, went down, mm-hmm. basically. And so from then on, we were, you know, when he got out, you could just tell he was severely damaged. You know, he lost 85% of his left hemisphere of his brain. And later on in our travels with Carl, we went to out to L.A. and a brain scientist out there did a test on him, ran mm-hmm. him through a CAT scan, and realized that there's one sliver on his left side mm-hmm. that the guy told us this is like a tornado hitting a house, jumping over one house and hitting the next house. Hmm. If it had not jumped over that one sliver, he would not have his mobility.
Wow.
So, you know, as luck has it, I mean, yeah, poor right. Carl, he has a stroke and has aphasia and can't speak, read, or write.
Yeah, yeah.
But he can get around, you know. Yeah. He can drive. He can do all those things. Right. So, well, all that being said, so, you know, the whole community in this town, as mm-hmm. you remember, yep. was, you know, devastated by this.
Yes.
And the doctors kept saying, you know, after a year and a half, you know, he's going to have gotten everything back that he's going to get back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll see what that is. Well, a year and a half comes by and he's gotten hardly anything back. And I'm talking, you can do, you know, flashcards with him. And,
right.
You know, hold up CAT. And,
right.
You know, and he'll get it once and then you do it again and he doesn't get it. It's not like you right. learn something and, you know, it just kind of sticks, you know,
right.
because it's a language barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So he... so after that year and a half, we were really devastated because, mm-hmm. you know, and at that point I went up to work on a movie and the other guys with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right,
up
right,
in
right.
New York. And, you know, it got to the point to that where we were in really good shape and I had time and I'm like, well, I want to write this, you know, I want to write Carl's story and
yeah.
see if we can tell Carl's story. And we had such a great community of people.
Yep.
You know, back here, that we could, you know, make this story and let Carl play himself in it. And so I wrote it with a narrator so it can speak his thoughts,
mm-hmm.
but then he, you know, would play himself in his story about his life.
Right.
And
now, you had never written before?
No, not really, no.
You had never directed before?
Correct.
Right.
It's plays. I directed plays.
Right. Right.
Last Meeting of the Night.
Yes. That's right. That's the other play that we did together.
Yes,
you were the
right.
director. I was in it. Yeah. Wow. Man. Jeez, another flashback. But I mean, yeah, with the camera, behind the camera.
Correct.
From a film standpoint, that was your first attempt at doing that.
Correct.
And obviously, it turned into something that...
It did. It turned into... It's probably the best thing I've ever done in my life. Or that I've done with other people. They helped as well.
Right.
You know, just because it became this phenomenon, really. I mean, just even in the filmmaking with, you know, Donna Scott and mm-hmm. Chuck Bloodsworth and Tanya Bloodsworth, we mm-hmm. all came together to really pull this thing off. And you know, it was a lot with Chuck's guidance that I was able to direct because Chuck had so much more knowledge of the camera and those
right.
things. But we just pulled this thing together, and we had over 200 people volunteer to help us shoot this movie. We raised $25,000 on the first reading of the script.
Wow.
All of that money practically went to food to feed the crew.
Sure.
Right? You know,
sure.
everything else was donated. The editing time was donated. The sound time was donated. All of that. So, so it became this huge community project where
yep.
everybody just jumped on board. And we were all really worried that, Carl, can he do it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can he act? How is he going to do this? And so what we would do is we would set up two actors to read the scene for him
mm-hmm.
so that he could see the scene happen.
Okay.
And then he'd be like, I got it. And then he would do the scene. You know, because at that point, he couldn't read the words on the page.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
So the words that he needed to speak. And the first day of filming, we just were looking on that monitor going, he's still got it. And the reason he's really got it is because he's always searching for the words. I mean, it's just his honesty is because he's really, you know, where
right.
some actors remember the words and they say them like they've known them all the, you know.
Right.
And, you know.
Right.
We're always searching for words.
Yep.
Yeah. So he was a natural. And then from there, you know, once the film was made, it became this front piece. It's a 40-minute film where Carl would go to these conventions,
mm-hmm.
you know, speech and hearing conventions, and we'd show the movie.
Yep.
And then he'd walk out on stage like this rock star.
Sure.
And, you know.
Right.
We went to Seattle and did it for the Neurological Nurses Association. There were 900 nurses out in this audience.
Wow.
And they... ate it up. It's the first time we sold the DVD.
Yep.
250 we sold in 45 minutes.
That's amazing.
It was like, yeah. I mean, just because it's such a powerful thing to see this man who struggled, and you see his whole story, but then he walks out on stage, and he does a 10-minute speech.
Yep.
And that speech is halting. It teaches something that he had to learn. We had to work with him a lot to get him to do it. But, yeah, it was just magical.
When you first set out to do this, I mean, was there any hope or expectation as to what it could lead to or where it could go or what it could become? Or was it just, let's just do it because the cause is so meaningful personally?
I think it was that first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just do it. Let's make this movie. And then, you know, and then what came out of it, great deal to Tanya and Donna in terms of, because they were kind of the managers that, you know, talked with the people, booked the gigs, did all of that strenuous, ugly work, you know.
Yeah.
I got lucky. I was the guy who went with him, you know, and did a question and answer with him afterwards. And,
yeah.
And so, yeah, it was really gratifying experience. I wish that it was still going on for him. But, you know, for the first 4 years, he was doing 17 gigs a year.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. And as a film itself, as a short film, I mean, it won a couple festivals or won a couple of awards?
Yeah, Big Bear Film Festival we won.
Right.
The Feel Good Film Festival we won.
Yeah.
Festivals were fun. I mean, they're, you know.
Did it give you any inspiration or motivation to continue to possibly do your own work? Or were you like, no, this is just for this special occasion, let's call it that?
Well, I still write.
You do?
Yeah, I mean, I've got another script I'm working on with Carl right now.
Oh.
Or for Carl.
Really?
That he's a character with aphasia, but it's not about himself.
Right.
He's playing a guy. You know?
Wow.
And so, you know, I've got 2.5, 3.5 acts of that, you know, and I haven't finished it yet.
Right.
So, you know, it's like Joe Blady is my muse, and she keeps pushing me to get back on it, get back on the writing horse kind of thing. And
that's awesome. I had no idea. That's so cool.
Had I not stepped up to do Veep and become production designer, that may have been the direction it had gone. But my direction went towards production design, and it just kind of, you know, my life has been completely involved in that. So that's why.
Well, I don't know, man. I think you created some good karma, man. I think you created some good karma as a human. Not that that was ever a problem for you, but that was still an amazing thing. You listened to the interview. You could see how much it meant to me personally.
Oh, sure.
For him. So, you know.
And now
thank
he's directing himself.
That.
Oh, yeah. No, it's, I mean, I got so much out of doing it. Carl's friendship, you know.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
All right, so, all right, we're done being schmaltzy. All right. Yeah, we get it, you're a good guy. I get it. All right.
So.
You big giant letdown. Jeez, what a huge waste of time. I'm just going to hit delete this whole damn thing.
See, the only ridiculous stories I have are acting. That's the only.
Oh, let me ask you this. Why the hell couldn't you find me a damn bed in Brighton Beach Memoirs that wasn't going to break? Do you remember that?
No.
You don't remember that?
No.
You weren't there for that. Well, of course not. It was the very last performance, but I'm sure you had to have heard the story. The very last show, the Sunday matinee.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I had gone home.
So I guess I can actually thank you for the baptism by fire into one of the funniest stage moments that I've ever been a part of. Because now, because now I have to figure out how to respond to him and how to get the money out. Because as you know, the show must go on. But yeah, that was your set. Yes.
Yeah, that was my fault. Yeah. So. I had a college experience like that. I directed No Exit.
Okay.
Right?
I know.
Jean-Paul Sartre.
Okay.
And there's three people in the room, and they've learned they're in hell, and that they're each other's hell.
Right.
And it's called No Exit because they can't get out, right?
Right.
At the very end of the play, the door is supposed to open, and then they have the choice to leave, and then they decide to stay in their own hell, right?
Sure.
So this one performance, the guy's tugging on the door because he's trying to get out, tugging on the door, and the doorknob comes off in his hand. And he's standing there, and they have to improv the whole end of the show because the door has to open, so they have the choice to go out,
right.
But with the doorknob in his hand, the door can't open.
No.
So, and I'm sitting next to my professor at the time, Hoyt.
Yeah,
Catherine.
Oh, Hoyt.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And I'm just like this, and he just pats me on the shoulder.
You're one of us now.
That's right.
Well, Jim Gloster, it has been so good to see you, man. Thanks for coming all this way and sitting down and talking with me. I can't, like, how long has it been? I can't remember the last time I saw you.
It's been too long.
It has been too long.
It's been too long.
Well, hopefully, you know, we get to see each other a little bit more often. You look great. I'm glad that you are doing so well. It's just been amazing to see what you have been doing and what you've been contributing to this crazy industry. And I'm really, really happy for your success.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this has been a pleasure. What a fun thing to do. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
This has been You May Have Seen with Jim Gloster. Thanks so much for listening. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout-out in the next episode.